So in women who have PCOS, when their insulin levels spike high, their ovaries get this message to increase testosterone output. And so if we can control the insulin levels, we can theoretically control those testosterone levels. And we can also control the ovary's ability to develop a follicle and hopefully ovulate naturally.
Welcome back to the Mastering Your Fertility podcast. This show is all about reclaiming health, enhancing fertility, and preparing for pregnancy. We're Kristen Cornett and Dr. Haley Nye, your hosts and the creators of the online fertility platform, Tiny Feet. This episode is brought to you by our online preconception and fertility optimization course, Fertile in 5 Masterclass. This course walks you through everything you need to know to prepare for a healthy pregnancy so you can get pregnant when you want to, stay pregnant, and bring your healthy baby home. With over 6 hours of video lessons, printable worksheets, and quick reference guides, and links to all of our top recommended products and resources, Fertile in 5 really lays everything out for you in an easy-to-follow, step-by-step program. If you're ready to stop stressing over getting pregnant and feel confident and empowered on your fertility journey, then this is the perfect solution for you. To learn more, click on the link in the podcast episode description or go to bit.ly/fertileinfive. And if you'd like to get a free sneak peek at the full course, check out our mini course on how to choose the best prenatal supplements, which actually walks you through step 3 of Fertile in 5 Masterclass. You can get signed up for the free course through the link in the podcast episode description or by going to bit.ly/prenatal supplements. All right, everyone, welcome back to another week of Mastering Your Fertility. We appreciate you tuning in and we're excited to help you learn more about your health and fertility. If you're new to the podcast, we're a holistic nutritionist and naturopathic doctor, and our passion is helping couples get pregnant naturally and have healthier babies. We started a virtual practice through Tiny Feet where you can schedule one-on-one consults to investigate your health and get your fertility on track. And we also offer online courses. You can learn more about us on our website at tinyfeet.co. And if you're local to the Portland, Oregon area, you can find Dr. Haley at Synergy Women's Healthcare. To learn more about working with her in person, visit synergypdx.com. If you've been enjoying the podcast for a while, we would really appreciate it if you'd share your thoughts with us through a rating or review on iTunes. Your feedback means so much to us, and reviews are one of the best ways to spread the word to other women and couples who can benefit from all of the in-depth fertility education that we share here on the podcast. We thank you all so much in advance for your support. Today, you're listening to episode 56, where we interview naturopathic doctor and women's health and fertility expert, Dr. Kevin Oberoi, about natural treatments for PCOS. PCOS, or polycystic ovarian syndrome, is one of the most common reproductive health conditions affecting women. It's estimated to contribute to up to a third of infertility cases, and it can also increase the risk of developing other chronic health conditions throughout life. Unfortunately, conventional medicine is pretty short on options for women with PCOS to optimize their health and fertility, which is why it's so important to be increasing awareness of natural treatments that are both safe and incredibly effective. We're very excited to have Dr. Oberoi here with us to share her knowledge and expertise about how women with PCOS can start working toward better metabolic health, balanced hormones, regular ovulation, and of course, improved fertility. So today you're going to learn about the diagnostic criteria for PCOS, which tests should be considered, and why this can be a difficult condition to accurately diagnose, the major driving factors behind PCOS and how it can manifest differently in different women, how the naturopathic approach differs from conventional medicine when it comes to fertility, specific nutrition and lifestyle recommendations that can have a huge positive impact on hormone balance and ovulation frequency, and important pitfalls to be aware of with PCOS treatment and how to avoid them. Dr. Oberoi also shares a little bit about her personal fertility story and how her experience has helped her connect with her patients and relate to what they're going through. So let's introduce you to Dr. Oberoi and get started on the interview. Dr. Kevin Oberoi is a National University of Natural Medicine alumna coming from an extended family of naturopathic physicians. After completing residency at NUNM, she specialized in women's health at her private practices in Portland and Salem, Oregon. In 2018, she launched a niche telemedicine practice and has helped patients across the globe optimize their fertility. Dr. Oberoi has also been invited to share her expertise in natural fertility care with the naturopathic community in 2019. By teaching the Advanced Gynecology Infertility elective at NUNM and presenting for the Oregon Association for Naturopathic Physicians as part of their monthly lecture series. You can find links to Dr. Oberoi's website in the show notes for this episode through the link in the podcast episode description. We hope you enjoy the interview. All right. Welcome, Dr. Kevin Oberoi. Thank you so much for joining us on the Mastering Your Fertility podcast today.
I am so excited to be here, you guys. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, we're really excited to talk about this topic of PCOS. We know that you know a ton about it, so we're excited to dive in. The first thing that we want to learn about, though, is just more about your background and what inspired you to become a naturopathic doctor.
Yeah, so I've been on this road since I was little. My great uncle was actually a naturopathic doctor and a chiropractor here in Portland, and my mom was his receptionist. So I spent a lot of time growing up in a naturopathic clinic. And my sister had a lot of health issues growing up, so we were kind of in and out of the ER with her. And that really taught me that I did not want to be that type of medicine. I am not the type of person that can be healthy in a hospital setting. So I have known I wanted to do naturopathic medicine and go to NUNM since about 10 years old, and I've been on that road. Really lucky that it went as smoothly as it did. I did my, I went straight from college to NUNM, did my residency there, and started practice right after. So, yeah.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. I think it's so, like, it's a pretty lucky experience to know exactly what you want to do and you're that young and it's just like a straight shot to like
yeah,
your career.
I realize how fortunate I am to have enjoyed to knowing what I'm going to do and very lucky to enjoy doing what I do on a daily basis.
Exactly, where you don't regret when you go through all that work that you decide that you wanted to do something else. Like what I did when I went to business school and then became a nutritionist after that. Yeah. Well, and I was in insurance sales for a while, so I think we've all had our little rounded pathways of how we got here, but we're all here, which is amazing.
Yes,
and we get to help other women now, which is what we love to do. So, well, so you actually have a personal journey with fertility, right? So, could you share a little bit more about that for the listeners?
Yeah, we're still actually on our journey, but our journey, my husband and I, we've been working on this for about 7 years. We've had a couple of losses along the way. We've tried a lot of different things. And, you know, as a naturopathic doctor, I had a very strong commitment to doing things naturally, but that's not always the path for everyone. So we looked at some assisted reproductive stuff. You know, we did some IUIs, we've done a round of IVF. And I really have learned a lot personally along the way and a lot that's really changed my perspective and how I work with patients. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's just really important for us as providers to recognize where people are on their journey and support them wherever they are and not bring any sort of philosophical, like, this is the right way, this is the only way approach. But my sister just had a baby earlier this year and it was really wonderful to watch her go through that pregnancy and that delivery and have a beautiful niece to play with and very inspiring to kind of see where we're at on our journey and figure out what we want to do next for our family.
Yeah. Well, that's really beautiful. I think it's just so difficult when you first start your fertility journey thinking it's going to go a certain way and mm-hmm. all of a sudden, you know, you look back 7 years later and you're like, what happened? And so I can really imagine how much that helps you work with your patients and with the empathy and understanding of like wherever you're at in that journey. We're just here to help and help, you know, hold your hand and get you through it. So whatever that looks like.
I remember I had a miscarriage and I remember going in for my D&C and the gynecologist who worked with me was just freaking amazing. But she sat there and told me, she's like, you're not going to want to hear this right now, but what you're going through is going to help make you a better doctor. And it absolutely has. I mean, I can sit in a room with a woman who's had a loss and I think hold space for her in a very, very different way than someone who hasn't. And so not that I wish that on anyone, but it definitely was an opportunity of growth for me. And I'm at the point now where I can look back and be like, okay, I see the purpose of what I went through.
Yeah. That's a really good silver lining, I guess, with all the struggle that people go through. I actually just listened to another podcast where the title of it was "With Illness Comes Opportunity." And it's very true. You know, both Kristen and I have our own experience with the illnesses that we've gone through and how that has really paved where we're at today in our lives and created this podcast. And I'm sure that's probably really paved how you focus on fertility in your practice.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. But PCOS is something, it's so funny. I remember doing my interview at naturopathic school and I had my interview with Dr. Winstar, a gynecology professor there. And I remember talking to her about how I was really interested in PCOS and that's what I wanted to do. And that's what I wanted to learn about. And it was so funny because we learned so much in school and then I ended up on the women's health shift working with her. And then she just kept throwing those PCOS cases my way, helping me learn more and more about that. And then in residency, working with her again and just getting to see a lot of that through school. But more recently, I read Dr. Fiona McCulloch's book, That 8 Steps to Reverse Your PCOS, and oh my gosh, totally blew my mind. Such a great book, such a great resource, and has really given a lot more structure to the way I think about PCOS and the way I work with those patients. So it's been, a particular area of interest of mine for a while now.
Yeah, that's a fantastic book. It's such a great resource. I love that there are so many incredible women's health books and resources for women now that are really geared toward educating the patient, you know, and obviously we need resources for providers as well. But a lot of these books that are really geared toward the patient are amazing resources for providers, not just to learn and kind of conceptualize some of these issues differently, but also to empower the patient and help them kind of be on the collaborative team with you as you both work together on their health and improving their fertility.
Exactly. And I think for anybody with any sort of metabolic factor and PCOS being such a big one, because they do so much of their own management with their nutrition and their exercise, and they have so much power over their health outcomes that way, the more they know, the more successful they can be. And so I am so thankful for all of these books that are out that are helping patients learn how to talk to their doctors and learn how to be just so much more than an observer in their healthcare.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It's really important too with PCOS because it is such a wide spectrum. I mean, it's taken us years as practitioners just trying to sort it all out in our brain. I can only imagine somebody who's just being told, oh, you might have PCOS and like, wait, what? Like, and then now they need to start their journey on what does that mean for me? And, oh, but I don't have these symptoms, but I have these symptoms. What does that mean? And so let's really get into that because it is a confusing syndrome. And, and it starts all with the name. Like that right there is super confusing.
It's not even a good name, is it? Polycystic ovarian syndrome, when so many women with this diagnosis, their ovaries are not even having those cysts at all. So yeah, we definitely need a new name for this, something that's a little bit more descriptive.
Yeah. And I think the big associations are working on that as we speak, I'm sure. So tell us what the diagnostic criteria is for PCOS and why it's sometimes a difficult condition to accurately diagnose.
Sure. So PCOS is the diagnostic criteria basically cover around three main areas. One, is there any issues or imbalances with the periods? Are they there? Are they regular? Are they skipping around? So having symptoms of irregular cycles is a checkbox in that diagnostic criteria. Second is having any signs or symptoms of high androgens, those hormones that are more testosterone based. So whether it's high testosterone, whether there's high DHEA, or whether there's just symptoms of it, like body hair growth, facial hair growth, acne, those sorts of symptoms alone can also check a box on the PCOS diagnosis. And then lastly, are those ovaries actually affected? Do we actually see cysts on those ovaries? So having at least 2 out of 3 of those boxes checked is sufficient for diagnosing PCOS, which in some ways is nice. I think it does capture an accurate diagnosis for women where it might have been skipped before. But I also think that it can get a little loosey-goosey on the edges. And I think some women might be getting lumped into that PCOS picture when that might not actually be what's going on if you're going on symptoms and you're really not looking at labs.
For sure. Yeah, I think, you know, we talked about that, like how it's both over and underdiagnosed when we had Dr. Laura Bryden on the podcast several months ago. But that was kind of fascinating to me to hear about like how some women are put into this box when they don't belong there and other women are not put into this, you know, category when they actually do based on, you know, if we were actually looking at all of these criteria appropriately for that woman.
Yeah, it's difficult because I think everybody wants that label. Everybody wants that diagnosis because they want that confidence that, oh, now that I know what it is, I know exactly how I can treat it. But the endocrine system is so complicated and PCOS is such an individualized condition that I don't know that having a label always helps every person. And especially with fertility, you know, everyone wants to avoid that unexplained diagnosis. So there are times when, you know, having the label of PCOS or having another label can make you have a sense of control that may not actually be there.
Yeah. So let's talk for a second about what kind of tests women might actually go through to evaluate for this diagnosis.
Yeah, absolutely. So the main thing I always think about with PCOS is that the metabolism is a huge part of it. Women who actually have PCOS, the way their body deals with blood sugar and insulin is a part of the problem. So we really need to get a good sense of that, looking at, you know, fasting glucose levels, fasting insulin levels. After reading Dr. McCullough's book and doing more research, I'm a huge fan of the glucose tolerance test as a way to really understand how insulin levels might be affecting ovarian function. So I think it's really important to look at that metabolic piece. And even if a woman's hemoglobin A1C levels are fine, what's her insulin doing? We might be catching things really early. We might be catching things before the pathology is super advanced, and we might be able to have a much better impact now. So the oral glucose tolerance test, I think, can be really, really enlightening. On the hormone side, looking at testosterone levels, total testosterone for sure, maybe even free testosterone. I like looking at the DHEA levels too. And then, you know, if she's cycling in a particular way and we can order that day 2 or day 3 LH and FSH and anti-Müllerian hormone, then we can really learn about how her hypothalamus and pituitary are talking to her ovaries and get a sense of what that is looking like as well. So in terms of blood testing, I think the metabolic and the hormone testing are important. The pelvic ultrasound is always nice to either rule in or rule out the ovarian cysts. And hey, if we happen to be able to say, yep, there are fibroids or there aren't any sort of anatomical problems, that's always helpful information. I'm a huge fan of diagnostics. I really like having answers for people, just so we know what we do and don't have to worry about in their journey.
Yeah, so true. I definitely agree with that. I do feel like, you know, clients come to us sometimes and they're like, oh, I have PCOS. And I'm like, let's take a look at your labs.
Yeah.
And really see whether or not that is really part of the picture. Because I do hear quite often, actually, women being diagnosed based on just ultrasound alone. Mm-hmm. But then they start to like listen to podcasts like this, or they start to read books and they're like, you know, I'm not really sure that I have PCOS based on, you know, the sort of set of symptoms. Irregular cycles and cysts are technically enough to diagnose mm-hmm. it, but it does help to have some lab evidence of what's really going on in their body so we can more accurately determine whether that's something they're really dealing with or not.
Right. And then we can actually treat the cause, because if there is no insulin issue, if that's not why she has cysts, or if that's not why she has high testosterone, then we need to figure out why she does and treat that cause and not waste time, you know, going on months of dietary changes and supplement regimes when that's not going to fix anything. So I'm a big fan of really figuring out what all the imbalances are so we can be very targeted with our treatment.
For sure.
And there's a couple other diagnoses that can mask PCOS or actually look like PCOS, but it's not. Mm-hmm. The non-classic congenital adrenal hyperplasia is one, which is just a genetic disorder, but it manifests as high androgens, and you might have acne or, you know, the facial hair growth or abnormal hair growth somewhere else that really looks like PCOS, it can also stop your cycle as well. So anybody who's getting evaluated should be evaluated for that as well. And then the other one that often gets misdiagnosed as PCOS is hypothalamic amenorrhea.
Oh yeah, definitely.
That's a big one. And I know that we talked about that with Dr. Laura Bryden as well. But it kind of, I'm going to get on my soapbox. Like it just, I feel so infuriated sometimes when physicians just drop you in that PCOS box, even if you're a lean person, without really investigating, like, how many calories are you eating? Like, what's your diet like? And, you know, do you actually have high androgens? Because most women with hypothalamic amenorrhea don't deal with the high androgens, yet they're still getting this PCOS diagnosis and either being put on birth control pills, or if they're trying to conceive, probably just going straight into like Clomid, letrozole medications and pushed into reproductive endocrinologists. So
there's also a big cultural piece. I mean, women who are from Southeast Asia and the Middle East, we have more body hair, we have more facial hair. And
oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Western countries, it's just really, you know, it's a checkbox on a document that you fill out at your doctor's office. And if you happen to have body hair, the doctor's going to be like, oh, there's a point for PCOS. So I think that we, as doctors, just we really need to keep open minds, and we need to be critical thinkers, and it can't be just about sticking a label on somebody. You know, as in naturopathic medicine, I think we have a little bit more leeway because we're going to go with our more foundational treatments, whether it's nutrition and exercise or supplements. But if you're thinking spironolactone or Clomid, I really hope people are getting their diagnosis straight before signing up to go on some of these medications.
Right. Yeah,
absolutely.
Totally agree with that. So as far as, so we might have a diagnosis if you get the correct one, then what are some of the driving factors of PCOS and how can it manifest differently in different women? Because again, once we talked about this before, is that there's many types of PCOS or a broad spectrum, right? It presents differently often.
Right. So I always think about PCOS kind of in layers, and Dr. McCullough's book really helped me think about PCOS kind of on a spectrum of how severely that insulin blood sugar imbalance is affecting those ovaries. So in women who have PCOS, when their insulin levels spike high, their ovaries get this message to increase testosterone output. And so if we can control the insulin levels, we can theoretically control those testosterone levels. And we can also control the ovary's ability to develop a follicle and hopefully ovulate naturally. But some women, I mean, especially women who do fall into that lean PCOS type, we don't see the overt symptoms of insulin resistance that we do in women who have the classic PCOS diagnosis. So they may not have the issues with their weight. They may not have that waist hip circumference measurement, but that doesn't mean that they don't still have higher than expected levels of insulin. So I think it's really important to, even if you don't see a woman who falls into that really common description of PCOS with her physicality, you're still looking for that blood sugar dysregulation. And one of the things that I found really interesting when I was researching PCOS for the advanced gynecology class I taught at NUNM earlier this year was talking about how women with lean PCOS have to work so much harder to stay lean than women who don't have PCOS. They have to really control their calories. They have to really exercise. So this is kind of what you said, is that as doctors, we need to be asking women exactly what they're eating, exactly how much they're exercising, so we can tell how much effort is going into that. So we can also look and see, you know, how much are the adrenals put into this? I know Dr. Laura Bryden talked to you guys about the adrenal aspect of it. And I think that is a huge part of what I do in my practice, is really look at how women's bodies respond to stress and how adrenal function can impact ovarian function. It's really interesting. I was reading an article that talked about how progesterone, which is secreted in small amounts from the adrenal glands, is actually part of the coordination of ovulation. It can help synchronize the LH surge, but only if there's a sufficient amount of estrogen in the body. So for women who have the hypothalamic amenorrhea, that's part of why we're not seeing that ovulation happening regularly. So looking at stress, looking at the way the adrenals are functioning, it's a really big part of helping women who aren't in that classic PCOS picture. But there's also the category of women who might have the blood sugar issue and have polycystic ovaries, but maybe we don't see the androgen issue. And I know there's some conflict about whether that's technically PCOS or not. But Dr. McCullough talks about that in her book as kind of a fourth type of PCOS that we need to kind of wrap our heads around.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I really resonate a lot with what you said about like, hey, we need to really be asking women, you know, what are you eating? Like, we include a food journal in our intake now, because when you ask somebody about their diet, or they have like, you know, just a small space on an intake form to talk about what they're eating, most people don't recall quite as accurately, you know, what their daily looks like. And, you know, I used to do 3 days, and now I've increased it to 5 days, because I feel like, and really 7 days would be better, because I feel like for the first couple of days, you always kind of want to make it look as good as possible. And then eventually, like when you're filling it out, then you get more honest as the days go on, more upfront about what you're really doing. But yeah, I think that's a really important piece, is not just taking a nice thorough health history, which is important for evaluation and diagnosis, but also looking at what's really happening on a daily basis in their lives. And that's not just food, but also, like you said, the stress piece is really key.
Yeah, I think a lot of our health histories, and I know in my practice, you know, my office visits are an hour long for the initial visit, sometimes longer for my fertility patients, because all these nuances really matter. But I think, and this is something that I talk to my students a lot about, is as naturopathic providers, as nutritional specialists, our words carry a lot of weight. And I think whenever we're talking about nutrition, we have to walk that line of not instigating any sort of disordered eating patterns. Women with PCOS are already at a higher risk for disordered eating. And so I think this is a conversation that needs to be done really carefully. And, you know, I always am telling my patients, I'm like, no judgment. What did you have for breakfast? No judgment. How often do you have dessert? Because I just want to know, not that I have a sense of right or wrong or what the exact level of sugar, you know, grams in a week should be, just so I can know, because once we know where we're at on the map, then we can figure out how to get where we're going.
Yeah, that's a really important point, just because a lot of women who have a PCOS diagnosis and have that really classic presentation, you know, with the abdominal adiposity, struggles with weight, insulin resistance, they're very sensitive about that, because it's typically something they've been dealing with for quite a long time at this point. And it is risky, you know, to start talking about ways to restrict the diet, to start to manage that a little bit better. That's a great point, being really thoughtful about that discussion.
It's interesting too, because what I notice is already, because we have the title of like naturopathic doctor or nutritionist, is that it already comes with this sense of like, we might be judging them,
exactly.
I bet your diet is perfect. It's like, we have to just have like something they sign of like, I'm not perfect. Trust me. Like we're just totally human, and we're just here to meet you with wherever you're at. So I think that's hard. And so that is a good point to try to be cognizant about that.
Well, I've also met with women in practice who have a little bit of emotional trauma from working with providers. You know, in conventional medicine, the nutrition discussion is typically lacking, because that's not a tool that's really robust in the conventional medicine toolbox. And so a lot of women have either, you know, had the experience or the feeling of, well, you're just fat and lazy. And, you know, I have had a client recently that told me that she's literally just been told that multiple times over the course of her journey since a young child. And I'm just like, that is so damaging in so many ways. So anyway,
I think it's very common, and I don't know that doctors necessarily mean it when they say it, but I think PCOS patients hear it. If you could just lose weight, you could fix this. Mm-hmm. As if this is some sort of like easy little snap your fingers. And I think that when working with any condition where there's a metabolic factor that someone doesn't have control over, you can't put it that way. You cannot put the burden on the patient to figure it out when you aren't even taking time to explain to them how to do that.
Yeah.
So I feel like this conversation with PCOS patients, it just has to be so appropriately done, and it has to be done with so much respect. And I don't know that, I can't speak for conventional medical doctors, but I don't know even that our naturopathic students are learning the tools about how to have these conversations appropriately. Yeah.
Well, I wanted dive in a little deeper with that, because I imagine as a patient who gets diagnosed with PCOS, or anybody who gets diagnosed with anything, their thought is like, did I do this to myself? Is this my fault? How did I get this? Like, why is this happening to me? So could you give us a little more background on your thoughts around like why women do get PCOS?
Mm-hmm. So PCOS is, I think, like so many other conditions, it's a combination of genetics and environment, right? And there's a lot of interesting studies out of Scandinavia that look at comparing women with PCOS with metabolic issues in their siblings. And also really interesting studies about mental health issues in women with PCOS and then mental health issues in their siblings. So there's definitely a genetic component there. And then environment absolutely can play a role. And I think that is where nutrition and exercise advice can be beneficial for people. Like when it comes to diet, Dr. McCullough's book really helps me understand and reconceptualize that PCOS, to think about it less as a blood sugar issue and more as an insulin issue. And similarly with diabetes, less of a blood sugar issue and more about what is insulin doing in the body.
So stepping back just like one more step, because you're, for the listeners to just try to understand, is that usually, I mean, almost 100% of the conventional medicine model and even functional medicine, everything, we really focus on blood sugar. And so that's kind of like your hemoglobin A1C, your fasting glucose when you go in and get your labs done. But insulin is a different measurement, and it's actually what is, it's like the step before the blood sugar, right? It's the hormone that's coming out of your pancreas and responding to foods that you're eating. But, and then that's, so we're talking about measuring the insulin.
Right. So insulin being, how do I take blood sugar and put it into my cells so the cells can actually do the work, versus just leaving the blood, the sugar in your bloodstream where it's just running around making inflammatory changes. So in people with a diagnosis of PCOS or similarly a diagnosis of diabetes, that pancreas likes to pump out huge amounts of insulin, even if there are relatively small amounts of sugar in the bloodstream. So there's like this miscommunication, this mismatch about how much insulin it takes to get the sugar into your cells. And over time, your body becomes less and less receptive to insulin, and your pancreas is like, okay, let me kick out even more insulin to get the blood sugar into the cells. We can look at food. We're finally learning how to understand how food affects insulin levels. A lot of people have heard of the glycemic index, about how much carbohydrate makes your blood sugar go up XYZ amount. But now we can also do that with insulin levels, and how much does a certain amount of food cause how much of an insulin release. And you can do, you know, mix and match your meals to kind of minimize your insulin output. And on the other hand, you can alter your exercise to make your body more receptive to insulin. So your pancreas gets less and less messaging about how much insulin to put out every time. And I've also been reading a lot about intermittent fasting and how that can be an effective way to really balance out insulin levels as well. So I think that learning about, and frankly, what I've learned is how to eat in a very simple foundational way, about eating your three meals a day, having your meals be a good mix of vegetables and proteins and some healthy whole fiber, whole food carbohydrates. It's nothing crazy. I don't think anybody needs to go on any sort of really restrictive meal plan to have good control of their PCOS. But I think that we're finally starting to see the science explain why a normal, simple eating plan, that the way our grandparents and our ancestors used to eat, why that works well for our bodies. And so I think we can look at a lot of, when we say environment, we can look at both how people grew up eating, how they grew up moving, and how that might have interplayed with their genes to create, you know, more of a PCOS picture once they actually reached puberty and had some of those hormonal conversations come online.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I do kind of want to dive into the nutrition and the exercise piece a little bit more, but I want to step back and ask a question, because you mentioned what insulin is doing and how important that is to the whole PCOS picture, but it's also important to overall health picture. And I feel like PCOS is kind of viewed as just a fertility issue. Like, it just affects a woman's ability to ovulate regularly and get pregnant. But women aren't always informed of some of the things that they're at higher risk of because of this diagnosis. And so, not to like scare people, but just for the awareness piece, like, what are some of the overall health things that are connected to a PCOS diagnosis and this metabolic dysregulation?
Right, that higher risk of diabetes, that higher risk of heart disease, endometrial cancer. There's so many things that as doctors we need to keep in mind that when we identify and diagnose a patient with PCOS, we're not just talking about explaining why her symptoms are the way they are today or explaining this is why, you know, you might need Clomid to help you get pregnant. Not that that's what I ever do, but some doctors do. But we also need to be thinking about, you know, in 20 years and 30 years and 40 years, what is her risk going to be for cancer? What is her risk going to be for heart disease? And how do we really prevent that? Because knowing things decades in advance, that's empowering right there. That gives us so much time and it gives us so many tools to really be helpful for people. So while that diagnosis that day might carry some emotional weight to it, we can have a really positive impact in her lifespan down the road.
So true. I do feel like, you know, especially women who are diagnosed earlier on in their life, they're like, okay, well, we're just going to put you on birth control for regular cycles. And then when you want to get pregnant, take fertility drugs. And there's not a lot of education about why it's important to optimize things as much as possible from a preventative perspective because of this higher risk of other issues that can arise as a result of this metabolic dysregulation and hormone dysregulation that happens in a woman's body who's been diagnosed with PCOS.
Absolutely. I honestly feel like the usage of birth control pills in teenagers with PCOS is a huge disservice, and what they actually need is like a referral to a nutritionist and a naturopathic doctor to help them explain how their bodies work so they can make more educated decisions about what to do next, because they will have some decisions to make about how to pursue their fertility down the road. And it shouldn't just be, you know, masked from them until they get married or they reach that point in their life where they're ready to start their family and they're ready to be pregnant, you know, a month ago, not a year from now.
Yeah. And it takes, you know, we learned from Lisa Hendrickson-Jack, she's done a lot of research on this too, but getting off birth control, it could take up to 2 years before your body actually regulates. And if you had some type of syndrome beforehand that was being masked, it could take even longer. And it takes a lot of effort, diet, lifestyle, just trying to get your body reacclimated to being off of birth control and dealing with the symptoms of PCOS to actually start ovulating regularly and increase your chances of becoming pregnant. So I totally agree with you. I'm a huge advocate of all women or young girls when they first start menstruating that they understand their bodies and like if their signs or symptoms of PCOS, that they totally understand that this could be a lifelong syndrome that they need to learn how to manage and not just being masked and then waiting until they want to have a baby.
Right. I think it's mainly just an idea of birth control is not the only tool to clean up your hormones. It is not the only option out there.
Amen, sister. Oh, man. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the naturopathic approach then. So besides birth control,
my favorite.
What are some of the top things that we would start doing?
So for me, whenever I'm picking a treatment plan, it's always, you know, what is the goal? What is the physiologic imbalance that I'm trying to resurrect? And so for PCOS, number one is always getting that insulin level well controlled. And then getting women ovulating regularly. When it comes to fertility, those are the top two things I'm always going after. And so I think first about, you know, the diet and the exercise piece. So we work on that either, you know, in my office or I refer out to a nutritionist if my patient feels like they want more specific guidance, if they want a little bit more help with meal planning and things like that. I think having a nutritionist on the team who can field those questions is really helpful. And then similarly with exercise, I just had a new patient yesterday coming in, very clear, very kind of stereotypical case of PCOS, and she goes to Curves 4 days a week and she does her half an hour of cardio and body weight exercise. And, you know, I have had to work really carefully to figure out how to counsel women about exercise. I think exercise is one of the most important things. It's the most important habit any of us can have, one of the hardest habits to develop and one of the easiest habits to break. So for her, I, you know, first started by saying how awesome it is that I think that she has created this habit and she's doing it really regularly and she has a friend that she goes with. But Curves is mostly hydraulic and body weight. And for women with PCOS, strength training and moving and lifting really heavy things is incredibly beneficial. And so, you know, talking to her about whether, you know, once a week or maybe on the weekend, can she go to a gym? Can she start getting on some machines, or does she feel safe starting to lift some heavier weights? Again, not that you can't get a really fantastic workout with body weight, but I think with PCOS, they have that high androgen, high testosterone hormonal situation. They can use that to their advantage by increasing their muscle mass. And that feeds down the line to really improving their insulin levels. So for me, that insulin piece, managing that's number one. So diet and exercise for sure. And then we talk about whether we want to use metformin, whether we want to use berberine, whether we want to use myo-inositol. Myo-inositol, you know, that's been studied head-to-head with metformin, found to be just super effective in helping with ovulatory benefits. So that's definitely the area that I lean on. But I also, you know, my practice is very insurance-based, so I have to recognize that there are financial issues that might influence a patient's decision to go with a supplement versus a medication. The sad reality of healthcare in this country that finances play a role that way, but they do. And so counseling women on, you know, if we are going to go with metformin, we got to make sure you're on a really good B12 folate replacement, because that's a package deal right there. You know, it's interesting when you look at the mechanism of metformin, it doesn't really fix the insulin problem. It's really just reducing that output of glucose from the liver. So it's not my favorite drug, but the studies do show that it seems to help women with PCOS. So we gotta at least acknowledge that piece. So those are the ones that I usually start with. And the new patient that I saw yesterday, it was some diet stuff, some exercise stuff, myo-inositol, and let's get some diagnostics to see where that lands. After that, I try to figure out whether we need to really work on digestion, whether we really need to work on adrenals, whether we really need to work on mood. Because I see my work with PCOS patients as a journey. It's not something that's going to be taken care of in one or two visits. So I try to be strategic about what's our first phase of treatment, what's our second phase of treatment, and how do we go from there. But yeah, those are kind of my fundamentals to start with. You know, beyond making sure some of the other naturopathic stuff, is her vitamin D okay? Is her iron okay? Yeah. Is she getting on a really good prenatal? Those sorts of things.
Yeah, that's an excellent start. I wanted to ask a little bit more about the exercise and why you suggest, you know, lifting heavier weights or muscle building is the go-to recommendation there.
So it's interesting. This really big article came out either this year or last year, and it was a great summary of all of the various studies on nutrition and exercise. And ultimately, the conclusions are there is no perfect guideline for women with PCOS, and it's really just about getting them exercising regularly. But what I have seen in my practice is that strength training, when we get that increased muscle mass, we see those insulin levels start to stabilize a little bit. We don't get as intense of an insulin peak after their meals. So I think that that's helpful for women. I also find that moderated strength training is a little less stressful on the adrenals. Again, most of my patients with PCOS are struggling to lose weight. They have really absorbed this message from the ether that you need to cut calories and do high intensity exercise. And I just don't find that that's a great fit for a lot of them when they're coming to me, also working full time, also having these other stressors in their lives. So I think that strength training, you can do it less intensely, you can do it less frequently, but still get a lot of benefits from it.
Yeah, I love that. I think there's this this kind of misconception that the only real purpose of exercise for a woman with PCOS is to stimulate weight loss, but it's not really 100%. About weight loss, is it?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I often tell women with all various diagnoses that I'm not telling you to exercise to lose weight. That's like the least important part of it for me.
Right.
Exercise is not the best way to lose weight. So
yeah. I always cover that with clients when I'm making exercise recommendations, because it's really not the point. Like, exercise is supportive to your body and to your metabolism for other reasons, but the point is not to exhaust yourself and put yourself into a major energy deficit just to try to get weight off. It's really important to understand like the metabolic benefits that go beyond just losing weight. And it's really diet is kind of the main focus. If you need to lose weight, if you're trying to lose weight, the dietary piece is the main strategy, and exercise is more of just a supportive strategy, and it should never feel exhausting or depleting.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That is the other nice benefit to strength training, is that we often see women start to lose inches before the scale moves. And I think that can be a really empowering thing. And that is my guidance for most of my patients with a PCOS diagnosis, is not to use the scale as a marker. You know, get a measuring tape, get your waist and hip ratios, write those down once every 2 weeks. You'll see those change so much faster than you'll see the scale move. Yeah. And, you know, all of the data shows us how important muscle mass is for women in their peri and postmenopausal phases, how important that is for bone density and managing cardiovascular disease risk. So putting on as much muscle now in your 20s and 30s is definitely the way to go.
Yeah, it's really
about body composition.
It's definitely against our cultural norms and how we grew up. You know, I know my mother growing up, it was all about step aerobics and losing the weight and how many calories can we burn within an hour session. And I'm having to really kind of break away from that mentality and that cultural norm, which is still very rampant. And, you know, we have CrossFit and all that now, but still, we still have like cycle gyms and we have all sorts of stuff. It's like, how many calories can you burn in like an hour period? And yeah, endurance is great, but it really does come down to the muscle mass and how not only is it going to help you lose the inches around your waist and help you become more insulin sensitive, but it makes you feel strong, more confident throughout your day. You feel like it helps nourish your joints so you don't have joint pain or muscle pain, helps increase energy. I mean, there's so many benefits to walking around with a stronger body.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. And you know, I don't know about your practice, Haley, but in my practice, I have so many moms and they are so tired and they just want to have the energy to play with their kids. Exercise is a mechanism for that. And so if we can help these women before they even get pregnant with the kids that they want to have energy to play with, I just think that's fantastic.
Yeah. So building that habit. And I love what you said earlier. Well, it's unfortunate what you said earlier, but it is the hardest habit to start and the hardest or the easiest one to quit. And I think part of that, I was actually talking to Matt the other day, was that evolutionarily we are programmed to expend the least amount of energy.
Yep.
And, you know, 2000 years ago, exercise wasn't, well, way earlier than that too, but like exercise wasn't a word. Like nobody was like, I need exercise today. Like it was never, no, that is very much like a modern thing. Like this idea of like, we need to exercise because it was absolutely 100% necessary. You had to go out and collect your food and, you know, kill animals and like you had to expend energy. And so conserving energy is just absolutely the norm. So it's absolutely a mind shift and like this habit that you have to persist and create because you have to overcome that evolutionarily like mindset of don't move and don't expend energy.
Save it all for later. Something bad might be coming down the road, but our lives are very comfortable now. We're not too likely to run into a famine or anything like that. So we have to be grown-ups and do the not so fun thing about getting a workout in regularly.
Yeah, for sure. So let's touch for just another second on nutrition. I know you kind of summarized this a little bit earlier, but like obviously the main focus is on controlling insulin levels, but a lot of women think that they have to do this with an incredibly restrictive diet. And that's not an approach that we typically take with clients. I don't think it's necessary. You know, what you were talking about was really just making sure that we get balance in there, you know, that we're not going overly crazy with carbohydrate and making sure that we're eating whole food carbohydrates and that we're balancing that with other macronutrients. So, I mean, is it really focused on the most variety and the most whole foods without overly restricting any single category of macronutrients?
I think that macronutrient balance is critical. And I think that individualizing diet is really important. So even when I have a patient in front of me and we're going over labs and the diagnosis is PCOS, I tell her that her PCOS diet is going to be 100% different than any other person with PCOS. And so we have to figure out how her body responds. So we're going to start with plan A. You're going to do that for a few weeks, and then you're going to come back and we're going to see how that went. Because I think it is, again, I think it's human to look for oh, this is my label. I can Google it and I can find the diet for this label and I follow the diet, I'll be fine. Except you have no idea who wrote that. You have no idea about the labs of the person they wrote that for. And so I think this idea of putting on the detective hat and saying, we have to look at nutrition as a very individualized journey and we have to look at how your body responds. And again, most of these women have already tried the low carbohydrate. They have already tried this restrictive diet or that restrictive diet before they ever got to me. So a lot of times that's what I will do is I'll reflect back at them that this is what you're telling me you've already tried. It hasn't gotten you the results that you're looking for. So let's not just retread old ground. Let's try something different this time. And I always tell them, again, for my fertility patients, antioxidants, that's where the egg quality comes from, right? So antioxidants come from fruits and vegetables. So first, make sure you're getting all of that in. Then make sure you're getting enough protein because you're going to be hitting the gym and you got to move heavy things around. We got to get that in there. And then when we're doing starches and carbohydrates, the majority of time, let's get those from whole foods. And then once in a while, yes, have some bread, have some pasta, have something that makes you a happy, whole, complete person. But don't feel like you have to be on this incredibly restricted diet all the time. Because very honestly, if that worked, most of our PCOS patients wouldn't need
it. Would be pregnant.
They've already tried that.
Mm-hmm. Totally true. Right. And I think it's also really important to recognize that a lot of these restrictive eating plans focus so much on what you can't eat and they don't really tell you what you should be eating. And in a fertility setting, what you add to the diet is easily as important as what you take away. You know, getting rid of some of those processed food, carbohydrates, that's important. But it's like you said, getting the fruits and vegetables in and where you're getting antioxidants and nutrient-rich foods. I think a lot of restrictive diets, people end up eating like 5 or 6 foods on a regular basis because they're like, well, this tastes good and this is what I can have. And there's just not enough nutrition.
Absolutely. I mean, we also just have to acknowledge our food is not as nutritious as it used to be.
Yeah.
So we have to acknowledge that that's part of it. We have to work harder to get our nutrients from our food, which means greater quantities of fruits and vegetables and greater frequency and greater variety of that. I mean, and then it gets confusing because people are thinking about eating organic and eating local and eating, you know, and not having plastic wrapped foods. And just yesterday I had to give that patient permission to go to Trader Joe's to buy a couple of pre-packed salads to have them in the house because, you know, if you're running around crazy at the end of the day, I would much rather her come home and have a salad than stop at Wendy's and pick up a burger on the way. So I feel like giving people
permission,
some ideas to make healthy eating easy. We need to actually do that. It's not logical for everybody. And again, as people who work in this field, for us, it's stuff that we think about all day, every day. Most people don't think about this as much as we do. Most people aren't troubleshooting as often as we do. So,
that's true. We're a little obsessive, aren't we?
Well, perfection isn't the goal. Like, I think so many women are in this. A lot of us are, you know, type A. We're very focused on doing things like 100% correct. And I do think that women around exercise, around diet, we have this kind of all or nothing mentality. So it's like, oh, if I didn't do it completely perfect today, then I might as well just fall completely off the wagon and eat whatever I want. It's like, no, perfection isn't the goal. And there are a lot of steps that you can take on the journey to improving your diet. And just taking one step forward, like you don't have to do everything completely 100% perfect. Like, oh, every single thing that I ate today was completely homemade and was like the perfect macro balance at every meal. It's like, no, just make your next choice better than the last one. Like
exactly. That's, you know, that's the thing people, you know, when they feel like they fail at their meal plan, I look at it. I was like, you ate salads 4 times this week. That's fantastic. That's 4 more salads than you had the week before. Way to go. Good.
It really does make a difference.
Failing.
Yeah. Well, I think too, they, you know, going to the Trader Joe thing, I mean, it's true. They have a lot of packaging. And you think like, oh, if I get this thing, then I'm going to get exposure to plastic and then it's just all going to be not worth it. And it's totally toxic. And we think that even our good food is toxic. Mm-hmm. And it's like that, that literally is, I think, like a diagnosis of some, like where you just orthorexia or something where you just get scared of everything, like even the kale that's like at your local grocery store. And and we really need to get away from that because, I mean, it is true. We do have to be aware of these things. Like obviously as physicians too, we need to understand like where toxins are coming from, but it's much, much healthier for you to have a plastic wrapped salad from Trader Joe's than it is to go to Wendy's and get that hamburger. Mm-hmm. So it's like, yeah. What's the trade-off here?
Yeah. I think a lot of it is bringing them off of that perfectionist ledge and letting them realize how many great options there are, even if they can't hit the perfect option.
Totally.
But I think that's where mind body work comes in. Like, that's so important. It's such an important component of, and that's something that I'm realizing more and more in my practice as I realize more and more personally that's mm-hmm. important for healing, and especially on the fertility journey, because it's so easy to get caught up in every little amount of research and Googling you can do about your specific health issues and, oh, what else can I try? What else can I do? It is really hard to kind of get off that hamster wheel of, I must do everything. I must, you know, keep trucking along and keep trying. And it's hard to give yourself permission to just say, you know what? I really need to take care of my mental and emotional health today.
I think it's critical. Building that into an
everyday practice where you give yourself grace and you don't force yourself to do all the things that somebody else told you are the right things. Like, you need to take care of yourself.
Mm-hmm. I think that infertility work, especially, I feel like the mental health stuff is not highlighted nearly enough. And I think it needs to be talked about in every stage of fertility care. I think, you know, when I was going through IVF, I had a really hard time with it. It was a really traumatic experience for me. And I was so thankful to have my therapist and my naturopath and my acupuncturist, because those are the people who took care of me. I felt like my IVF doctors, amazing as they were, and I 100% respect them, I really saw them more as technicians. And I got my care from my crew. And I think that when we look at all the data that's coming out about the rates of depression and anxiety and PTSD after fertility work, I just feel like as naturopathic doctors, as counselors, like, we all need to be checking in with our patients all the time on their mental and emotional well-being. And even for women with PCOS have a higher risk of depression and anxiety. How often are we talking to them? You know, are we always spending time reviewing their testosterone levels and looking at their diet logs? Or are we doing the PHQ-9 screening? Are we checking in with them and saying, hey, how is this? Are you having these symptoms? How is your sleep? Are you having heart palpitations? Do we need to get you into counseling? Do we need to get you hooked up with a support group? Do we need to get you, you know, to your local Resolve support group to be in a room with people who just get it, who understand?
Yeah.
That's one of my, like, my key things, the things that I think are so important with fertility work, is helping people with that mental health side of it.
And I think it's us that can give them permission to do that, almost, where when they hear it from us of like, hey, seek out a therapist or seek out a support group, or let me help you, let me give you some resources. I would hope that that would also give them a little bit of permission to be like, you know what? Yes, I need help. I am going to do that, you know, and understanding how important that piece really is.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we are going to wrap up here, and mm-hmm. you just gave us some amazing advice already. But if you were to give one more piece of amazing advice to women facing a diagnosis or struggling with their fertility, what would you like to tell them?
So for women who are struggling with fertility, I would tell them to go after a diagnosis. I just recently saw a new doctor. Like I said, we're still on our fertility journey. And one of the most empowering things she told me was, who told you what your diagnosis is? And I was like, well, nobody's actually said it. I assume it's unexplained, but nobody said it. She's like, yes, your diagnosis is unexplained infertility. That means your options are A, B, C, or D. And I can't tell you how amazing that felt to be like, it's not that I am some horrible, like, super extreme case that nobody understands and nobody knows how to deal with. Even for diagnosis of unexplained, there are specific treatment options that have been studied. It's not that I'm at C, you know? And I feel like, as much as I'm thankful for our fertility patients having the internet and having support groups and having all these resources and books, it's still difficult for them to know which options are going to apply to them. So creating a team of providers who's going to walk with you on this journey, who are going to support you and getting the family that you want, that's the number one thing, is to seek out providers who are going to help you get a diagnosis, who are going to help you know what your treatment options are, and who really believe that you can have the family that you're looking for.
Yes,
so,
I love
so
that.
Amazing. I know. Over here clapping. Yay. yeah, that's amazing. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Oberay, for joining us today. This conversation has been really enlightening, and I'm sure it's going to be very helpful for women that potentially have PCOS or are struggling with it right now. And tell us where our listeners can find you.
Sure. So I am on Instagram, Natural Fertility Online. I practice in Portland and Salem, Oregon, and I also do some fertility care by telemedicine. I've got patients in South Africa and Virginia right now, so that's pretty cool. But yeah, Natural Fertility Online is the easiest place to find me.
Okay, excellent.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it. Keep putting this out. This is such an amazing resource for people. So I'm really, really glad that you're doing it.
Well, thank you.